Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the People's Square. I think we are live, yeah. So today, it's going to be me and Zoltanis. Borzoi has some stuff to do. He's got a new baby. So, there you are.
Yeah, I'm here, and I'll be able to read the donations, but I'm probably going to mute for a while I'll make sure that the baby goes to sleep.
Sounds good. Take care of your business, Borzoi. So today we're going to talk about Giovanni Gentile and a book that I do not believe was translated into English until now. Is that correct, Zoltanis?
Yeah, it was published in 1899. It was actually one of his earliest works under La Philosophia de Marx.
But, yeah, I remember reading back when I was a Marxist, there was an anecdote of Lenin praising this book, which is crazy.
It is correct.
Yeah.
There's a lot of references to like German idealism in it, but there's also a lot of references to like Engels and also Marx in it, along with some other various socialist thinkers like Sorel, Proudhon, that are also in there. There's also some stuff from Krakow, which is like a guy that Gentile used to work with very closely before they had a falling out. But yeah, Lenin actually read it and he praised it as being a very insightful analysis of Marxism.
Which is fascinating because as we know, Gentile went on to inspire Mussolini, much like Plato inspired Dionysus in Syracuse. Very much the same relation, would you say so?
Yeah, I would say so. Like, as far as like Gentile, there's actually a quote I have at the start of it where Mussolini says that Gentile started the entire journey for him as far as like when it came to fascism. But I would say for Gentile, it probably goes back to Sorel a bit more, besides like the influence of people like Vico and Hegel, which yes. Hegel's another person that's very influential to Marx too, which is kind of funny.
Yeah, of course. You know, there's also a direct connection between, say, Fichte and Kant to Hegel.
Yep.
That of course Marx ignored for the large part.
Yeah.
What would you say about that?
So when it comes to Marx, like his interpretation of Hegel is actually mostly a rejection of most of his philosophy. The only things that are actually retained from Hegel is the dialectical process, and that's replaced with class theory. So that's how you end up with dialectical materialisms. It's class struggles or class conflicts. It's only the proletariat and the bourgeoisie. Nothing else exists, really.
All right, let me translate real quick because this can get a little esoteric. So, for the brainlets out there, historical materialism is Marx's theory, which is the concept that socio-ethical norms and culture and institutions and governance and so on, that all of these realities are informed by, it's actually a really shitty theory. They're informed by the way in which we produce products or goods or the means of survival, correct?
Yeah, and that creates a class relation. So, like, right. Things like race, for example, are seen as a product of class relations, which which fundamentally isn't true at all.
Right. I mean, this is actually the crime of Marxism is that, you know, you have very interesting figures historically that created the socialist idea. And Marx kind of jumped in and hijacked it and turned it into something very frankly silly in a sense, and the concept, it's just simply like you said, a rejection of the Hegel's philosophy, and also a rejection of, say, the concept of, you know, what Gentile believes, which is that human consciousness can shape the material world, while Marx believes the reverse. He believes that the material world shapes human consciousness, right?
Yeah, like the big distinction for like Gentile, it's actually slightly a deviation from Hegel too, because Hegel's understanding of like dialectics is emphasized more like on ideology. If we're talking about Gentile, it's more so through the act of thinking. So if somebody comes to like a type of idea, it doesn't necessarily need to be rational. And you have a group of people with the same idea that becomes like a general will, which is a state. And then the state is basically functioning on a dialectical process. And that's mm-hmm. used to justify corporatism because it's supposed to create like a harmony between the different classes, for example. You also have an example of like corporatism and Hegel's philosophy with the corporation. And these are things that really aren't in Marx at all, but there is elements of it in syndicalism with like the syndicate system.
Right. And I believe that the phrase that Gentile would use is actualized idealism or actual idealism. And that's exactly
actualismo.
Right?
Yes. Actual idealism or actualism.
And one thing, just not to get into the philosophy right away of this, it must have been quite a challenge to translate these very complex concepts and ideas from Italian to English, no?
So I actually got a PDF of this from a friend on Discord, and it was actually like shortly after I got back from being vanned by the feds, if you remember that conversation.
Yeah. But,
yeah. It was like after that, I was on Discord, somebody sent me the PDF, and I looked into it. It was never anybody who actually translated it, which kind of surprised me.
Amazing. And,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Well, it's actually...
Was, you know, Gentile was the most, possibly the most influential Hegelian in Europe in the 20th century. Possibly. Definitely in Italy.
No? Not just in Europe. He was considered one of the most influential like philosophical academics, and not just Italy, but all of Europe in general. A. James Gregor talks about that in like Mussolini's Intellectuals. Much of the academic like stuff to fascism actually isn't even translated. Only a select few of them are. Like, for example, Panunzio, a lot of his stuff isn't translated. Rossini mm-hmm. doesn't have a lot of stuff that's translated. Neither does D'Ambrus.
Right. And I believe also the one that is translated and is very famous, of course, the Doctrine of Fascism, which is which is under Mussolini's name, but is believed to have been mostly written by Gentile, correct?
Yeah. So, like, if you go through like the Origins of Doctrine, there's kind of differences when you read it in like writing style. Some of it's very philosophical. Some of it's more politically realist or like Machiavellian, like in writing. The politically like more realistic and dry stuff is by Mussolini, whereas a lot of the stuff it's more philosophical is by Gentile, which he's very philosophical when he speaks. It's actually kind of hard to understand him a lot of the time unless you have references to like what he's talking about.
I totally agree. Mussolini was pure politics, and Gentile was more of course esoteric philosophy and so on, but Mussolini tried very much like me, I try to do this too, try to incorporate esoteric philosophy and kind of actualize it politically in what perhaps Gentile would call praxis. I know that word is associated with all this gay shit from anarchists and stuff, but
it actually originates at Gentile first, praxis,
right?
Which a lot of them don't talk about. There's actually a second writing that he has on Marx, and it's called The Philosophy of Praxis, which is also in the book that I did. It's more of a continuation of what he's critiquing Marx for, and it's on basically like theoretical Marxism versus practical Marxism, and he considers practical Marxism to be a form of like state socialism or like state capitalism, which are interchangeable with each other, because mm-hmm. it's you still have like a value form of commodity production within the state structure. It's just using corporate groups to direct production, and which benefits the state or the nation if we're talking like in practical terms. And to him, that's like a practical form of socialism, whereas like impractical socialism is where you basically like destroy half the country in the process of trying to industrialize it, which is what you had under Mao or Stalin. Where you would literally have like large sections of the population just be purged or killed.
You'd have to kill like half of the people in your country. I mean, that's the ultimate irony of this, is that mm-hmm. you know, fascism is a bloodless revolution in the sense that it rejects status quo conservatism by default, Gentile and Mussolini, look towards the past and the future while rejecting the status quo. But you can actually do that without killing millions of people. Imagine that. You know?
Yeah. It's like modern China. Like, I usually like look at China as kind of, I'm not a China like dick writer, by the way, but like modern China, when it comes to like their economic reforms, they started out under like the very unpractical ideas of like Mao. And nowadays they use like a national trade union and firms to control a lot of the companies, the cooperatives, and most of the major companies in the country are owned by people who are high ranking members of the state, which is the same thing that you had like in National Socialist Germany, where a lot of the privatization was just redistribution to high ranking party members. So they can effectively allocate resources, which is something that Marxists use as a straw man, because they'll call, a lot of them will call China socialist, but they won't talk about that. And a lot of the reforms that they credit China for were actually economic reforms that can be found with fascist Italy and National Socialist Germany first.
Absolutely. I mean, I get some flack from people too about saying this, but essentially modern China is a national socialist state. It's a Han national socialism. It's very, very little in common with Marxist thinking or Maoism and so on. It's essentially corporatism that is bound together through Confucian thought. So it's going to be very unique to China, but it's literally fascism. And of course, tankies that are opportunistically now pretending to be pro-China or whatever will completely ignore this, while at the same time, like you said, the straw man that Nazi Germany privatized this or that, which, like you said, isn't really true. They just put things in. I mean, first of all, Nazi Germany had a planned economy. And second of all, they had very powerful, like, for example, they say they destroyed the trade unions. Yeah,
the labor's front controlled most of the economy, which is something they don't talk about.
Exactly. Like, and if you go to the Salo Republic in Italy, I mean, that was literally transitioning to pure workers' control.
Yeah, it had the second most state-owned economy next to the Soviet Union. The guy who was in charge of the economic socialization under that was literally the founder of the Italian Communist Party, Niccolo Bombacci. But they don't even talk about during the implementation of, say, the Rocco laws during the 1926, I believe. Or it's also called the Syndical Laws, too. But during that period, that you actually had worker cooperatives even in the corporate state. And like, that's something like retards like Vosh, like the standoff, like worker cooperatives. Like, worker cooperatives were a thing literally in fascist Italy. Yeah, he doesn't care about socialism. Like, I don't even know if he knows about that, but he doesn't care about socialism, even if he knew about that.
Yeah, no, exactly. And of course, you know, just reading the very simple biography of Gentile, you know, he wasn't as I don't want to use the word extreme, but as radical. Or he was actually, in his own way, I respect it to an extent, very principled, and was actually shot by communists. He was killed, assassinated by communists in 1944, trying to save various leftists who were in prison, wasn't he?
Yeah, it's also a bit ironic too, because one of his other reasons besides saving them, because he didn't believe in killing fellow Italians, he just thought they should be put into exile, which is something Mussolini did. Like, if you actually look at dictatorships, he has one of the lowest like actual like kill counts out of anybody. When it comes to political enemies.
Exactly.
But Gentile also wanted them released because he was arguing they couldn't argue against him effectively, which makes it kind of funnier.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, so essentially, you know, I remember seeing, I don't know if you're muting yourself, but you don't have to do that.
I'm doing that as other people at my house, by the way, sorry.
Oh, okay, I get it. No worries. So essentially, a couple of years ago, I believe, Dinesh D'Souza, you know, big lolcow, everyone laughs at him.
Yeah,
he mentioned Gentile as the origin to kind of create a link between communism and Nazism and fascism. And
he's not entirely wrong. He's not the same thing.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, it's kind of like the bell curve of the left side and the right side, the really stupid and the really smart. And Dinesh D'Souza's on the left side. Right. He's on the left side of that and making an argument that sounds really stupid on on the surface. But there actually is something there to at least work. There's a grain of truth in that.
This would be surprising for some people, but Zizek is like a post-Marxist. Fascism is like a post-Marxist ideology itself, because it sees itself as retaining the elements of Marxism that are practical. And the practical solutions of Marx, a lot of it is the critiques of capitalism and capital, but it's about where it stops. Like, a lot of his solutions are not practical. And there's also there's a bit of a critique of that Gentile has of Marx that's not in the book, but it's more from like an essay that I'm going to be trying to get my hands on. But Diego Fusaro, I don't know if you know who he is. Capital, he's considered one of the about main, where it stops
figures like
a lot of his solutions are Marxist philosophy in Italy. And he's also a big fan of Gentile, which a lot of people would find interesting. And he also endorsed Casa Pound, even though he identifies as a communist, which is very interesting too. Gentile critiques Marx as being a confused idealist. And the reason why he does that is because if you read a lot of Marx, he talks about alienation. Alienation is a moralistic doctrine that came from the utopian socialists.
Saint Simon and... who's the other one? It's Saint Simon, and I forgot the other guy.
But yeah, I don't know their names either, so it's fine.
Well, Saint Simon.
Like utopian socialism is like predicated like on a religious argument most of the time, or like you also have a lot of German idealists that also took it up. Well, a lot of the ideas of alienation are founded like on a moralistic argument. And the problem with Marx when it comes to moralism is that his materialism actually has no necessity for materialism. Right. And when you actually know anything about actual materialism itself, because everything was reduced to economic stuff, it's no longer appealing to a moral structure in the first place. It's just appealing to like utilitarian benefits towards certain groups when it comes into the economic relations. And in this case, it's the proletariat. In the case of capitalism, it's the bourgeoisie. And he calls him a confused idealist for this reason, because it's an element of idealism that's in his philosophy that he never really got rid of. And you see that with a lot of modern Marxists, which is why I think they're confused. And
it's the moralism. Almost like he did it on purpose.
Yeah, it is almost like
that. I don't
think
he's confused. I think he was malicious, Marx.
But at the same time, even though he has that inherent to him, he has some views that aren't really like PC too, like his views on the lumpen proletariat, but Yeah.
But there is a deeply moralistic, almost religious aspect to Marxism that is not actually talked about as much as it shouldn't. Conservatives have no argument for it. Now, Gentile and guys like that, the fascists actually did have an argument. I mean, Hitler had an argument. He said, well, Marx did this to basically manipulate people. That was his perspective. And Gentile is a little more charitable, but it's the same idea, isn't it?
Yeah. You know who A. James Gregor is, correct?
No, I do not.
So, like, he's a academic historian. He's considered one of the foremost historians on fascism. And he knows a lot about National Socialism, too, but most of his work is on, like, Italian fascism. Keith Woods, when he did his response to Is Fascism, Capitalism, and Decay, which I'm also working on something. I've linked it to you before. But Gregor's main argument is that he said this during a university at Berkeley in California. Fascism was a variant of classical Marxism, a belief system that pressed some themes argued by both Marx and Engels until they found expression in the form of national syndicalism, and the materialism was rejected for the idealistic positivism of Hegel. So, like, it's using socialism, but from an idealistic interpretation, which, like we said, it goes back to Hegel, and Marx is more of a misrepresentation of that. And I do think he is a bit of a straw man meant to get people involved into
Yes.
like a false dialectic
I
for
mean,
that
if
reason.
he had never existed, the only socialism that would ever have existed would be this fascism, national socialism, which had to dust the fingerprints of Marx off of Hegel to actually bring it to, this is going to sound funny, bring Hegel to fruition, if you want to use
Yeah, I would
the
actually
word
agree
that.
because, like, the utopian socialists, for example, their influence can actually be traced over to, say, like, the Christian socialism of G.D.H. Cole or guild socialism of Arthur Pinty or even distributism with, like, G.K. Chesterton and A.K. Chesterton. And those people have direct links with fascist corporatism because corporatism is a form of guild socialism or syndicalism. Distributism is a form of corporatism. And that's one of the direct links right there. And Hegel, I would argue, is actually influenced by this because in the philosophy of right, he has an entire like section dedicated on it, on the corporations themselves. Like even the structure of the corporations with the how top down they were, it looks very similar to like Mussolini's corporate state. You can also see similarities with this with like the Constitution of Fiume with the D'Annunzio.
I think that's very interesting and very true. I think also that the kind of I don't know, maybe call it debasing of Hegel kind of takes away to kind of play off E. Michael Jones a little bit, kind of reduces the element of logos that is very prominent in Hegel and in obviously in Kant.
It does. It does because Hegel is talking about a realization of God when he's talking about in terms of like his historical theory and the state itself. And Gentile speaks about the state much of the same way, that it is a manifestation of the people, and the people are God consciousness because God is in all of us, which is very like it's very mystic and esoteric, but it, yeah. Well, even when it comes down to all of that, it does seem like the young Hegelians, which are just the Marxists, aren't even really Hegelians. They just retain the dialectical method, and then they attach Hegel to themselves so they can seem more academic when they're really not.
Well, that's what they do. They come up with some bullshit and they call it science.
Well, one thing I can think of is like, say, like late stage capitalism. Its origins are actually found with Werner Sombart, and Werner Sombart was a part of the conservative revolution, and he was also and he endorsed and voted for Adolf Hitler, and he never joined like the National Socialist Party, but he was a supporter of the regime, and he's the guy who coined late stage capitalism. Well, what was late stage capitalism? It was a globalist finance capitalist system that commodified culture and deracinated people, and it was controlled by Jews. And modern Marxists won't talk about that. Same with super capitalism. Who coined that? It was a guy called Brunner. Brunner was an early National Socialist thinker who founded the German Workers' Party, which is before the one that Hitler joined. This is in 1905, I believe. I could be wrong. Could be 1906. I don't remember exactly. He equates super capitalism to all land ownership and monopoly held by big Jewish like company trusts. And Mussolini also talks about super capitalism in a speech on capitalism decline. Everything's commodified and everything's about material consumption. And you have people like Vosh who use terms like super capitalism. They're literally stealing our words, our phrases, and our intellectual tradition and trying to make themselves seem more academic. And they're not a real academic movement. They're based on theft.
Well, that's exactly true, and you see this in the philosophies that they've stolen from us, the slogans and the concepts that they've stolen from us. And again, when I say us, I'm not talking about conservatives. I'm actually talking about the fascists and national socialists. And they've also stolen racialism from us. So it seems that the left is just there to steal our ideas and kind of warp them into antisocial, discord causing, you know, things that are bad for society, that cause instability, that cause hatred and things like that, no?
Yes. It's literally predicated on just creating a cultural revolution to destroy a state, a nation, and a people. And what you end up with is that you just end up with like what we have today, because like a lot of the cultural and the social issues at the left were predicating even at that time with like the cultural libertinism.
Yeah.
It kind of gets revived with like the critical theory of Gramsci. Then that carries over to the Frankfurt School of Marcuse. Then Marcuse, and when he goes to the United States, ends up working with the CIA and the FBI. And that's when you have the new left and all that.
And isn't, you know, one thing I always found interesting is that Giovanni Gentile, leftists will say, is not a socialist, right? Not anything to do with it. He's the polar opposite of a socialist. Yet somehow, because he's an idealist, yet somehow Gramsci, who, if I'm not mistaken,
Gramsci was a left wing interpretation of Gentile.
Yes, he was an idealist.
Talk about.
He took.
Yeah, he was.
He believed, he rejected the various aspects of materialism to an extent.
Even that anarchist retard that you debated on the modern day debates, he was literally like a Gramscian he was literally a Gramscian like leftist anarchist, which is why he seemed incoherent when he was appealing to materialism. His philosophy is built on a pseudo idealism.
Well, here's what's interesting. I think this is important for understanding what leftism is. Leftism is the hijacking of revolutionary nationalist ideas. We want to build a nation, build a state, build the culture, the civilization, the race. The left takes our praxis, our mechanisms, our ideas, our philosophies, and uses them for the polar opposite to destroy. So this is actually the real, it's not that there's, you know, Dinesh D'Souza is right to an extent that there is a fundamental similarity or core between the radical nationalists and the radical left. He's right about that. But the goals are completely different, right?
Yeah. So the goals of like Marx, like even though it really never happens, like the end goal doesn't, because like anarchists are brain dead. It's a stateless, moneyless, classless society. But of course, it doesn't function in what ends up happening is kind of like what Rockwell says in his speech on I think it was like on American National Socialism. He talks about how like the Soviet Union initially started out as libertine, then it ended up becoming conservative, which was the only way they were able to maintain things. They had to embrace like a form of nationalism.
Right.
And yeah, it just end up what ends up happening because it's dysfunctional in the first place. And I would actually go as far to
argue. Look at China.
Yeah, I would go as far to argue that we're actually the real left, and they're not even the real left.
You could argue that.
There's literally a publication from a national socialist in Denmark called National Socialism, a Left-Wing Movement, and it makes exactly that argument.
I've seen that. Yes, I've read that. And it's all about, makes a great point. For example, the concept of environmentalism.
Yep.
There's nothing in Marxism that, you know, this mechanistic kind of material.
It's about destroying the environment.
I mean, show me any social or political experiment that has committed more atrocities against nature than the communists.
The Soviets, when it came to whaling.
Yeah, somehow the modern environmental movement is somehow tied and linked to Marxism. And we know why that is. That's because wealthy Jews pay them to be that way.
Yes. Like, I can even think of like Jose Antonio Primo de Rivera's like last manifesto. It tells the phalangists, do not work with Franco, do not work with the bourgeois nationalists. You even have the publication Fascist Socialism, which is by a French fascist. I can't really pronounce his name. So grug brain moment. He makes the argument that a vague nationalism is a bourgeois defense and that a real nationalism is socialist and it is neither capitalist nor bourgeois. In fundamental terms, and that we are like real socialists and real leftists, but like the modern left are just literally like a distraction and a tool of finance capital to take over a state and to destroy it and take power and solidify itself. Even Marxists like Bordiga realized this. He made the astonishing statement that anti-fascism was the worst thing to come out of fascism. And let me see
if I can find a quote in the United States. You know, and it's so true, because if you look at, say, the real thinkers behind analytical philosophy and liberalism, say, Thomas Hobbes and Karl Marx don't really seem to disagree on first principles. Both are materialist.
They don't.
Yeah, they believe that that somehow everything can be explained by material forces. There's no such thing as human consciousness being predicated independent of these material forces, and it's simply not found throughout history. You know,
this right here, it is. It's from Bordica's view of Antifa, quoted from the proceedings of the Fourth Congress of the Communist Internationale, 1922. We hold exactly the opposite point of view, so let's set the record straight immediately. The revolutionary movement, freed from the servile admiration of America's free world, freed from the subjugation of a corrupt Moscow, and immune from the siphonic pudetry of opportunism, can only reemerge by recovering its original radical Marxist platform and by declaring that the content of socialism surpasses and negates such concepts as liberty, democracy, and parliamentarianism, and reveals them to be means of defending and propping up capitalism. The anti-fascists work with liberals and therefore prop up capitalism.
Yeah, you know, you see that today. This is the point. It's a very basic point, but I say to socialists and communists, is that every time a nationalist force arises, the communists and the capitalists join forces, right? The British knew about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact through their spies before it was finalized and publicized, and they made the decision that they were going to declare war on Germany, not on the Soviet Union, for supposedly violating the sovereignty of Poland, right? So
correct.
They always work together, and that's because capitalism and communism are essentially based on the same idea, which is that material forces come above all. And also, of course, I think Gentile says this, actually, solipsist egoism, right? That's liberals and communists both kind of...
He argues that all materialists are fundamentally individualistic, and you just have to look at the ontology in which both of them start themselves on. Liberalism fundamentally says that individuals are pre-society, which is why you see libertarians and conservatives talk about how there's like no race and there's no inherent need for like a type of collectivism, and they're always deconstructing that. It's just their intellectual.
Now they're saying
roots.
There's no gender, because now they're endorsing Caitlyn Jenner.
Yes. Yeah, Fuentes is like congressman that he had speak endorsed
Mr. Gosar.
It. Yeah.
I made a joke on Telegram where I said I'd love to pay that guy a $250 Applebee's gift card to be in the dunk tank at the next NJP event.
I was actually ranting about America First on my YouTube channel, and then they got that video flagged off. Groypers did, so yeah. Really flagged by them.
The problem, and this is my critique also of the new right, with Pedro Gonzalez and Ryan Gudurski and all these guys that are coming out there. My critique of them is that you're a plant in water. It's not based on anything. You don't have, you know, again, I know E. Michael Jones has kind of turned it into a meme, but you don't have logos. And what I mean by logos is kind of a defense of Plato against these wreckers, you know. I mean, I know that there's these anti-woke leftists that go out there and they say that, you know, they're complaining about wreckers and this, that.
Yeah, like Jimmy Dore.
Yeah, but here's the problem, Jimmy Dore. Marx is the original wrecker. So if you're a Marxist, you're simply yesterday's wrecker dealing with today's wrecker. And you know what? If Marx was alive, he would side with the SJWs you hate.
Yeah. You just have to think about it. Like, since liberalism is operating on that individualist basis, like, the whole point of communism, of the classless, stateless, moneyless society, it was so individuals could fully actualize themselves. And that's why you have it talking about how they can philosophize at night and all this wonderful nonsense. If we're talking about with Gentile, because things are based on perception, nations are because me and you see that we're similar, so we feel that we are similar. We speak the same language, and that builds communal bonds. That communal bond is a spiritual value, and if you have enough people who think that way, it creates a nation because they perceive themselves as a nation. So it's a metaphysical justification of collectivism, and true collectivism can only be justified by idealism, because we have to understand we are a group, see ourselves as a group, and perceive ourselves as a group, and that creates a state, and the state then becomes the embodiment as us as a group. When a state does not embody that consciousness, it is not a nation, it is not a state, and that's part of the reason why I argue that America is an illegitimate nation state.
Right. Now, just to play devil's advocate for some entertainment value, I am curious to see what you'd say to this. You know, Karl Marx in Anti-During says, in attacks on idealists, he says, you know, according to idealists, now this is a bit of a straw man, but he says, according to idealists, a man who does not believe in gravity can jump into the ocean and not drown, right?
Okay, so that's actually ridiculous, because like most idealists will tell you that there is an objective reality. They're not fucking sophists who believe everything is relative. Like, if I put my hand in fire, it ain't gonna burn. That's not what they say. Like, Gentile says there is an objective reality because there is a prior consciousness that gives form to the reality, and that is God. And then you have multiple different consciousness, which is how you have perception and formation of nations, which is separate. And this is actually kind of further argued by like modern quantum physics with the Belt experiment and a bunch of other stuff. But then we're not even talking about Gentile's original claims, because funny enough, a lot of science actually backs up what he said back then now. And Keith Woods actually talks about in a video on why he's not a physicalist.
Right. And this is kind of so essentially, as I suspected, Marx was strawmanning the opposing arguments. You know, Marx was almost like an irony bro in his time. And I think that, again, the bread tube fags and all these wimps that someone like Jimmy Dore would say, oh, I hate these people too. No, those are the real Marxists, Jimmy Dore. They're actually following in the spirit of Karl Marx. And Karl Marx, you know, we could say like there are based Karl Marx quotes about, you know, he used to call people queers. And he used to call people the N-word and stuff at these.
Yeah, you know, wanting to exterminate the Slavs. That came from him, not Hitler, by the way, guys.
But that was just all part of his irony act. Like, he was the original irony bro in that sense. You know, like, I don't think
Bakunin has a pretty good critique of Marx. Have you ever heard of Bakunin's critique of Marx?
Very, very vaguely. I know that he was very suspicious that Marx was some kind of like Rothschild's agent or something.
Yeah, like, that's the quote I'm talking about.
Yeah. Why don't you read it for the audience?
Yeah. Marx is a Jew and is surrounded by a crowd of little more or less intelligent, scheming, agile, speculating Jews. Just as Jews are everywhere, commercial and banking agents, writers, politicians, correspondents for newspapers of all shades, in short, literary brokers, just as they are financial brokers, with one foot in the bank and the other in the socialist movement, and their ass sitting upon the German press, they have grabbed hold of all newspapers, and you can imagine that a nauseating literature is the outcome of it. Now, this entire Jewish world, which constitutes an exploiting sect of people of leeches, vicious parasite, closely and intimately connected with another, regardless not only of frontiers, but of political defenses as well, this Jewish world is today largely at the disposal of Marx or Rothschild. I am sure that on the one hand, the Rothschilds appreciate the merits of Marx, and that on the other hand, Marx feels an instructive, instinctive inclination and a great respect for the Rothschilds. This may seem strange. What could there be in common between communism and high finance? Ho, ho, ho. The communism of Marx seeks a strong state centralization. Where this exists, there, the parasite Jewish nation, which speculates upon the labor of the people, will always find the means for its existence. In reality, this would be, for the proletariat, a barrack regime, under which the working men and the working women, converted into a uniform mass, would rise, fall asleep, work, and live at the best at the drum. The privilege of the ruling would be in the hands of the skilled and learned, with a wide scope left for profitable crooked deals carried out and on by the Jews, who would be attracted to the extension of the international speculations of the national bank.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have
Sorry,
my
it's been long.
No, I have my critiques of Bakunin's things too. I mean,
yeah.
it does kind of seem though that
even Proudhon has a pretty good critique of Jews too.
Let me be charitable with Marx though. Bakunin is essentially like just he's engaging in ad hominem a little bit there.
Yeah,
he calls him
deicide.
Yeah. So yeah, and of course Marx would fling it back because of course Bakunin was an infamous fag, so Marx would call him a queer. Shut up, faggot. Like, that would literally be the discussions they would have. The thing I would say, though, is that Marx is in a sense, I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist here, but prior to Marx, the anti-capitalist movement in Europe was quintessentially anti-Jewish. I mean,
it was called the feudal socialists and his yes. manifesto. And like the feudal socialism is considered a precursor to like the fascist movement because it was mm-hmm. like an alliance between the proletariat and the aristocrats, and they wanted to reincorporate guilds into the economic system of the market economy. Right. And
which let me just interject there for a second. Marx himself, in talking about the guild socialists, admitted that the living standards and frankly the dignity of the proletarian, or what was pre-proletarian, I suppose, was higher under the guild system, that people lived better under the guild system. And nevertheless, Marx still supported liberal markets as an advance over that, correct?
Yeah, it's like under guild socialism, like under the feudal systems, you had pensions. If you were a worker and you were a member of the guild and you were certified, like you literally had like protections for you. You never had protections under like when capitalism first started because there wasn't any unions. Like even like right. The popes realized this was really bad. It was going to create a terrible reaction. And like if you read Marx, he doesn't talk about implementing socialism like immediately. The economic system that he actually puts forward is supply side economics, which is just a stand-in term for laissez-faire, which is why you see people like Blasch talking about markets every time you watch his content.
Yeah, it's quite amazing that Marx was actually, you know, and you see this too in the early days of the USSR when they were
new economic policy.
Yeah, they called it getting the ball rolling.
Yeah,
and what's funny is that
privatization.
It was a libertarian utopia. You had Wall Street Jews buying up all the state-run industries. You had competing currencies. You had proletarianization of the population. Now,
you had anarchists everywhere too.
Right. It was just like America almost, like early America. And you know, it's kind of like Stalin was sort of like, and say what you want about Stalin, obviously he's not a good guy, but he was clearly
better than Lenin,
better than Lenin and Trotsky, and he was clearly trying to take what he had, what he found himself in charge of, this ridiculous system, and he actually tried to make some sense out of it. If that, you know.
Oh, I just found a good quote by Panunzio from some of my citations. Panunzio, during a speech in 1927 in Milan, we syndicalists are productivists rather than distributists. We're determined to foster economic development to enable a syndicalist economy to attain a productive maximum for nationalism, which is crucial to the socialist revolution.
Right.
It's literally talking about socializing the means of production right there. But
exactly. Hold on a second. My lighter just disappeared. Hello, my lighter. Hold on. I have a person here that took my lighter away.
Lol.
Oh, okay. So anyway, what were we talking about? So the essence of this is that there's actually no reason for, you know, what I was talking about before was the revolution of 1848.
Mm-hmm.
And how grassroots organic anti-capitalist resistance led by figures like Richard Wagner, you know, was a proto-national socialist.
Yeah, Wagner working with Bakunin.
Right. Like
something they'll talk about.
This was a deeply, deeply rooted anti-Jewish movement. And then Marx parachutes in with his Communist Manifesto. That doesn't even sound like it's written by Marx, as Marx is a notoriously turgid writer. And you have this guy like saying, no, let me take credit for this here. And it would be kind of silly to be conspiratorial, but it was almost the Finkelthink of its day, Marx. You know, he was basically, I don't know.
He wanted capitalism to succeed so it would give way to a new social order, which is what he wanted. Like none of the real original socialists wanted that. They wanted to maintain the traditions and the identities of the nation states they found themselves in the communities they were in, the religions.
Obviously,
and Marx didn't want any of that. It's like a complete inversion of what socialism was supposed to be. You can even see something similar with like the Irish 1916 uprising. We literally had Marxists and nationalists working together for British independence for Irish independence. I don't know if I said British right there, but
I always compare it, and Ireland is a great example, and that's why you see quite a bit of Jewish attention to Ireland in recent years. Now that people there, you know, they have and outside antagonism from world capital. You know, Google and so on have taken over the Irish economy and mass immigration. So you see these antagonisms starting to provoke a response in the people. And they have a very recent history in Ireland of a kind of syncretic or third positionist revolution. And these are their modern heroes. These are people that lived in the 20th century.
Well, a lot of the 1916, it gave rise to like the Blue Shirts, which was like a conservative. It was like a conservative, like corporatist party.
Right.
It wasn't like fully fascist, but it was like close enough. Yeah. And then then you had the corporatist party that came out after that, which was openly fascistic.
Yes, O'Duffy, who's basically like a stereotype of an Irishman. He was basically a drunk cop.
Yeah.
It's a stereotype. I mean, the Blue Shirts were not very impressive, but I think now there is quite. I mean, you might disagree. What do you think of the Blue Shirts?
I mean, I don't dislike the Blue. The only like third position movement I don't like that existed in Europe was like Dollfuss's Austria. And
Yeah.
That's because I don't like Catholics at all.
Well, the neo-reactionaries, you know, you ask them, you know, who led your model state, and they'll all say Dollfuss.
Yeah, they usually pick him because, like, his second in command was, like, literally a monarchist Spurg that wanted to bring back the Habsburgs.
Insufferable.
But Dollfuss didn't even want to bring back the Habsburgs, so, like, they wouldn't have got anywhere even if he stayed in. It's just that Dollfuss was more of a way to kind of like not allow for pan-Germanism, which is like what Hitler wanted, which is the reason why he was removed. It's not because we Nazis, we don't like fascists. There's like people who actually think that the like Hitler like hated fascists, but no, like the reason why Dollfuss had to go is because he was against pan-Germanism. Like there's actually like an ideological reason for that. It's over the issue of nationalism and that's like the real reason why that happened. Like, I don't really mind like other third positionist movements though that existed. Like, I'm more of a fan of like, say, like the Falange and like Mussolini's fascism. I do like Hitler, but like, I'm more well read like on the Italian movements. I haven't read a lot of like National Socialist theory.
Oh, a lot of National Socialist theory, other than, you know, don't mind, I might rustle some feathers saying this, you know, Alfred Rosenberg's book is just silly. It's a silly book.
Hitler,
a lot of other stuff was destroyed. The Allies destroyed tons and tons of National Socialist books.
Yeah.
And we don't even know the full extent of their ideology because the Allies made sure to not just conquer Germany, but destroy all signs that the Third Reich ever existed, from the eagles to the books.
I do know when it comes to Rosenberg, I talked with a guy called Ankensreich and another one called Fascifist on like Christianity in the Third Reich. And they brought up something I didn't know about, and that was how Rosenberg actually handed Hitler a copy of Myth of the 20th Century, and Hitler handed it back to him saying, "I'm sure it's fine. I don't need to read it."
I don't think that the National Socialists and the Third Reich, like, it wasn't really like an instruction manual or even treated very seriously inside of Germany, from my understanding.
There was different interpretations of like how National Socialism predicated itself ideologically, but most of the interpretations I do know of, from Heidegger and like Schmidt, was more of like an existentialist interpretation, which is like very Nietzschean, which would probably be in line with like what Hitler was putting forward, because most of his philosophy was built off Nietzsche. There is a difference in the philosophical foundations from like Italian fascism, but they're reaching the same conclusions and they're doing there's a lot too many similarities as to say they're completely different, which I feel like is kind of a straw man argument that like people who say we're original fascists, we don't need to work with the Browns. Like it doesn't work that way.
Well, I don't think Dollfuss was just some authoritarian, he's like a reactionary monarchists, and those people hated the Germans and the Italians more than anyone. And Dollfuss was, to my knowledge, a lot of people don't know this, but of course Ludwig von Mises was his economic advisor.
Yeah, he was an economic advisor for like 2 weeks and he was dismissed.
A lot of his theories were still like the gold standard. Austria was one of the last countries in the world still using a gold standard.
That is true. Know?
Just stupid, and that's why like all their people were starving. The Nazis took over Austria, and they had solved the unemployment problem in a year, which is quite remarkable.
One thing I can actually think of off the top of my head is like private property, for example. Like Marxists like to contend to that as like a point of like how fascism is actually capitalistic. You had private property even in feudalism; it just wasn't as distributed, but. Like, say, Jose Antonio Primo de Rivera, he has a speech. I think it's not on YouTube anymore. I think it got taken down, but my video of it. But he basically says that capitalism is anti-private property because it's built on monopolies and consolidating land, which we can actually see like with modern references, like Bill Gates, when it comes to like farming land, he just keeps consolidating lots and lots of land. It's anti-homestead and it's anti-farmer, and it's also anti-individual property.
Right.
When it comes to encouraging like individual ownership of property, this is probably going to piss off a lot of Marxists. In the 1936 Stalin's constitution, in which he drafted, he allowed for peasants and artisans to own plots of land and partake in private domestic markets. And Mao had small private land plots in the communes for the communist Chinese.
Yeah.
My references for the Soviets would be Article 10, the rights of citizens. They had the policy of private farming, which is talked about in The Myth of Capitalism Reborn, a Marxist critique of theories of capitalist restoration in the USSR. You also had profit motive, which is defined by Stalin as existing in the Soviet economy.
Right.
In the Hungarian Soviet, you have talks about small-scale private property ownership and consumer market economy existing, which means
and what the Marxists, what the communists in those states would say is that, oh, don't worry, we'll abolish it tomorrow, and then tomorrow never comes.
Yeah, they try it and it creates a famine, then they create the market reforms so they can stay in control. Like in Poland, the majority of the agriculture, almost all the agriculture, was privately owned. They don't talk about that, but they want to talk about how the evil Nazis privatized the economy, make capitalists rich. But that isn't how it worked. It's like you guys literally had a state capitalist economy, just that you tried subverting the you tried subverting the forces of it and ended up creating problems for your people in the first place. And like the fascists never did this. They utilized it for the state, and that's why it was more successful. And it, this didn't really happen for any of the red regimes until China. Like, the only other corporatist regimes that probably exist nowadays besides China are like Iran, Syria, and Singapore, which a lot of people try to say Singapore is free market. They're not. Most of their economy is actually state owned. It's just it's just people who are high up in the party are privately holding it.
There's also a strong nexus between Singapore and China in the sense that they have incorporated Confucian teachings as a kind of central ethical foundation for what mm-hmm. they're doing. You know, so in a sense, it's so bizarre to see American conservatives, again, it shows you how the worthlessness of conservatism, but particularly American conservatism. China is essentially a conservative society or a traditional society that has synchronized tradition with technocracy like the fascists and national socialists, and even to some extent, maybe Tories in a much more watered down sense, traditional Tories, not Margaret Thatcher. This is what an actual muscular traditionalism looks like. And why does it make you livid is my question. Well, of course, there's financial interests involved and so on. But the point is, it's so depressing to see how completely rootless and baseless the American right is. It's disgusting. Well,
the American right is founded on liberalism. That's fundamentally the problem with the American right wing in general, is that it's completely and totally liberal. And the only reason why the liberal values functioned in the past is because they had somewhat of an idea of what a community and like tradition is. And that's how you end up with like people like Buchanan, but like conservatism taken to its like fullest extent is how you end up with people like Gary Johnson.
yeah, or Caitlyn Jenner.
Yeah,
Caitlyn Jenner is the perfect conservative.
One thing I just thought of, I didn't bring up, is like a total
egoist. Yeah. One second. Let me grab my lighter. I'm a. 1 second.
Cigar stream.
You know, one thing before we move on, I'll say about Caitlyn Jenner is that
finally a Republican with balls.
Yeah, exactly. You know, well, what I say is, you know, unlike most conservatives, at least Caitlyn Jenner was once a man. I'll say this, that American conservatism, all these people that are shocked and outraged, right? Very, very, very reasonable that they are. They don't realize that the problem is the conservatism itself. You don't have the language or the categories from which to reject what Caitlyn Jenner is doing or is. You don't have the ability to articulate an answer, to hold up a dialectical side of this debate. So what do you expect? You either break with conservatism or you chop your dick off. Those are the two options. If you want to do politics in the United States of America in any way, get ready for a future of Rachel Levine versus Caitlyn Jenner debating on a stage in the 2032 election. That's it. You know, I mean, I can't even imagine now that the trannies are the conservatives, what's going to be the next step for the Judeo left? Like what now that this is no longer, I mean, I guess they could have like a black tranny run against Caitlyn Jenner, maybe a child molester, maybe a I don't know. What can they do?
I think what's going to happen. I don't know if you saw. I think I linked it to you on Telegram. It was actually the executive order that was passed by Biden, like a few days ago. I don't know if you read it.
I saw that. Yes, I did.
Yeah, they can literally accuse anybody of being connected to the Russians, and they can freeze their bank funds, seize it, or take their property. And like, I was talking to Cultured Thug about this. I literally think it's going to be used on anybody who tries to run for office, like as a populist, mm-hmm. and they can use it to shut them down with the accusation they're operating for Russian influence. and they're probably going to use it on political dissidents to create more harm.
You know, I don't know if you saw this, but about I think it was last summer, Paul Craig Roberts, who used to be, I believe, a CIA agent, one of those guys that used to be in the CIA and is now like an anti-Israel intellectual, like a foreign policy intellectual. He was writing for a news publication, and the feds seized the publication claiming that it was run by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. Total bullshit. Oh, God. I mean, this guy is not an Iranian agent. He's obviously been around forever. And all he used to be in the CIA, and now he blogs about Israel and its toxic relationship to the United States, and that the Trump administration just said, oh, this is run by the Revolutionary Guard. Well, fucking prove it. Oh, they don't have to prove it. They just seized it. That's it. It's a joke.
Yeah, now, the whole point of them is just to crush political – it's all it's ever been.
Now, what do you think – what do you think of this? You know, obviously, the pretenses of liberalism are over in America. So – what do you think comes next? Like, how would you explain or articulate this new system in philosophical terms? It's not liberalism. What is it?
Well, the new system, it's more of like a fusion between like what people would call cultural Marxism and like cultural capitalism, because it's more of a symbiotic relationship between the left and the right to try and attack actual populists, and that's to maintain the status quo for neoliberals, and it's going full mask off because they know there's too many people that are creating too many problems. Like, say we will about like MAGAtards, like they were so in favor of like a fake nationalist. They thought that who they thought was a nationalist, they would like assault a federal building. It says a lot. Yeah. Plus, you had multiple different rallies that happened from Charlottesville to that.
Oh, and yeah, that was a game changer.
Yeah,
the election of Trump kind of caused them to snap, but then Charlottesville was like the cherry on top, and then January 6th is like the last straw for them.
I did a debate like a couple, like I think it was like it's 2 years now, I think, with Jangles, like that the weird like homo like Walmart version of Vosh. yeah, I basically
Jangles.
Yeah, I made the accusation that like liberalism is more totalitarian than North Korea, and he thought it was ridiculous. And it's like,
right.
it sounds ridiculous on like face value, but if you think about it, like they can freeze your assets, they can seize your property, they can literally like ghost you and throw you into a prison without a warrant and put you in solitary and torture you, make you go blind. They can kill you. They overthrow regimes, invade and like murder people, and they instigate racial chaos, and they also instigate cultural chaos in the country domestically, and then they censor people. It's like if that's not totalitarianism, I don't know what totalitarianism is.
I mean, that's what this whole bullshit about disinformation, censorship, deplatforming, hate speech, it's just to muffle your screams. It's a pillow over your face as they torture you. So
yeah,
I don't understand how anyone could be invested. Any intelligent person could be. I mean, someone was telling me, I believe it was who was it? It was someone probably on the TRS forum or something that I saw this. And they're saying they have a liberal friend, and they brought up all these critiques. They're like, the things you believe are wrong. And on top of that, if I say they're wrong, I get crushed by the system. So why do you how could you support the system? He said, well, I support it, and you deserve to be crushed. I don't believe. So essentially, he doesn't believe liberals don't like.
That's what Jangles told me when I debated him.
So they're not even pretending anymore.
Yeah,
so
it's
what, I mean, this is quite a bit like how they were behaving in the 1920s and 30s. How did that go for them? I mean,
yeah, people like Pelley very well. Ended up in prison.
I mean, people. We talk about. Last summer, a bunch of people, including myself, wrote a comparison of America during the riots, how, this anarcho-tyranny and so on. We very, very similar to the experience in Spain in the 30s. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, I've made that comparison, too, before.
It's uncanny. So you punish. So, you know, again, I said this last week, actually, to another guy, but I'll repeat it. You know, the government, the Republican government in Spain was not necessarily like a Soviet, you know, I think the Franco.
Yeah, it was just a basic libtard.
They were libtards. They were libtards.
Yeah, it was actually the anarchists that set it off.
Well, this is what happened. So libtards, like social democrats, created a coalition government with the Communist Party. And essentially they were running this like libtard anarcho-tyranny where anarchists, who are an independent kind of irregular army for the libtard government, anarchists were essentially murdering and looting and destroying, and just like now, destroying churches, burning down churches, raping people, killing people, destroying people's, you know, houses and small businesses. So what happened is that it's not that the Republicans in Spain necessarily endorsed this. They just tolerated it. And if the Republican government,
yeah, they did concessions to try and keep it, trying to keep things from getting worse, but it didn't exactly work. It's just like modern day conservatives, they keep conceding ground, hoping that the left doesn't beat them to death.
Well, here's the wonderful thing. I don't know if you've ever read there's a book by a Jew, Ziesblatt, and it's about how fascism rises. It's a very good book. It's totally from a Jewish globalist neoliberal perspective, from someone who's in charge. He's a Harvard political scientist. And Ziblatt says that what Spain, Germany, and Italy had in common was a weak conservative movement. And he says that in order to stave off a fascist or Nazi revolution in America, you need to build the Republican Party into a strong kind of magnet for discontent. So he actually compares the experience in Germany with Britain.
That's interesting, because there's a study from France that says that the center, or like strong mainstream parties that are rooted in the center left or center right, is how you keep radicals from taking over a country.
yeah, and it's absolutely true, because what happens is that, say, countries that had a very rapid plunge into away from the old order, you know, the aristocracy and so on, to a bourgeois liberal democracy. Mm-hmm. Those countries that went too fast didn't have a bourgeois conservative party that was rooted. So the fascists and Nazis basically just pushed the bourgeois conservatives out of the way. But if you look at, for example, the United Kingdom, the Tory party, which is the bourgeois party, they were able to actually mobilize the bourgeoisie into, you know, worthless endeavors, but mobilize them nevertheless. And thus, they're able to co-opt a lot of the sentiment that, say, Oswald Mosley was tapping into.
They've done that in America, too, by placing like really hard on the reactionary language of like Red Scare type shit. And yeah, I think that's the reason why you see a lot of like modern people call themselves like fascist go around saying that we're under like a communist Duganist conspiracy theory. One of them I can think of is Martinez Perspective, and he literally argues that Hitler was a capitalist, and that's a good thing, but which makes me want to tear my hair out.
Well, that guy's been literally, if I'm thinking of the same person, that guy has been like attacking me, claiming I'm a Russian agent.
He does that with Keith Woods too. I was supposed to debate him today, and I was supposed to debate him in his chat, and he was supposed to stream it, but he banned me from the chat and then said I didn't show up.
Well, the thing is, you know, I don't want to even give these people attention.
E-drama, yeah.
When I'll tell you this. I've seen the Duganist label used specifically against anyone who is principled against neocon wars on the left, and someone who is critical of capitalism. My critique of capitalism is perfectly in line with every single noteworthy fascist and Nazi in history.
Yeah, I don't think they understand
about that.
I don't think they understand Dugin at all, actually, because like his main idea of like multipolarity is a multi-civilizational model,
right?
And that doesn't necessarily mean America is gone. It just means you have multiple different civilizations that are not being invaded and destroyed by and taken over by liberalism, and that just means all the nations are separated by themselves, and then they have their own culture, their own people, and their own identity, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just they go on about Dugin because they somehow think Nazbol is taking over. But like, if we think about like Dugin and the Nazbol party, he left Litmanov's party because Litmanov was really like an anarchist spurg and Dugin was just a traditionalist.
Yeah. He was like a troll.
Yeah.
Litmanov was a troll.
And like the actual national Bolsheviks that are like in Germany with like Patel and Nikisch hated Hitler. And then like, if you read their manifesto, were just like actual just communists, but like they're completely different from like what happened in Russia, which had no ideology and no foundation.
No.
And Dugin isn't even a Nazbol or a fascist. He's just a trad fag like a Vola.
He's very much in that vein for sure. And what's so ironic in my case is that, to the extent that actual Duginists exist, they despise me for some reason, which is fine. I don't give a shit.
Yeah, they dislike you because they think all Wignats somehow end up pandering Republican talking points when they drop breadcrumb talks, which is like obviously false.
Those people, from what I've seen, I don't even think any of them are real. Like, they're serious. I think a lot of them are just trolls. But, you know, you can look. I mean, I've never been particularly interested in Dugin, not because I have some moral problem or some ideological problem with Russian nationalism, but more so because I just frankly find a lot of his writing to be a bit dry. And I'm not much of an esoteric guy with that kind of stuff. But I mean, I'm not against the concept. I mean, one thing I'll say about my understanding of what Duginism is saying is that Russia is a Eurasian power. Now, if you know about Russia, half of the country is in Asia. So that's technically true. So what are you going to do? Like, are you just going to kill all the people in Russia that are not Slavs? I mean, what are you supposed to do? You have to do something, right?
There's also something else that's kind of insane from them is that they somehow think Russia, like with Dugin's, going to fund all these like radical dissident movements and overthrow all these Western countries and take over everything. Like, and they think Russia is going to align with China for that. It's not going to happen. Like, China and Russia are only aligned in the sense that they're in opposition to America, but they're not going to ally with each other because China is better economically and better off militarily. Russia would become the subordinate partner. Wow. So that's what part of the reason why Russia pushes multipolarity is because it represents status quo politics and also means that you don't have people like invading and creating political instigations. So
let's say, for example, Russia exists. Well, let's say for example tomorrow that America is, you know, and I hope this is true. I think America is far, far worse of an influence on the world and on Europe in particular than Russia or China will ever be.
It is.
And that's something that, by the way, you know, all these Nazbols, guess what? The Nazis, like the actual national socialist groups in Europe, actually most of them outside of, say, Ukraine and the Baltics agree with me. Look at what Golden Dawn or some of these other groups
used NRM, Casa Pound.
Yeah, they all, like, you know, whatever the problems are with these other countries, America is by far the worst. You know, Russia doesn't force you to embrace homosexuality.
Well, American imperialism is homosexuality.
Right. But my point is, though, is that if America were completely reduced to its own borders internationally, there would immediately be problems between Russia and China. Because obviously, if Russia is the Eurasian power and China is the Asian power, well, there's going to be some arguments there, no? So, like, and this is actually the core of the Sino-Soviet split. This is actually what fueled it. And, of course, the communists, this is another thing dumbasses that talk about communism as this kind of independent world thing or whatever.
Communism is capitalism in decay.
Yeah. Well, the problem is that America chose to align itself with the Chinese communists against the white Soviets, even though the Soviets famously made a racial appeal to Nixon, to you know, the British. Brezhnev made a racial appeal, said, listen, we have to work together to save the white race. And specifically because the Chinese weren't white, Henry Kissinger and world Jewry expressed through the United States, decided to align itself with China against the Soviet Union. So these are all nuanced things in history.
You can
that the people that the Dugin hunters and the Dugin people, They don't even, this doesn't even enter their equation.
The closest thing to what those retards say is probably Franco Freda in Italy, which I don't know if you know who Franco Freda is because he's very obscure.
No.
But during the years of Lead in Italy, you basically had the KGB that was supporting radical fascist groups and also radical anarchist and communist groups to overthrow the Italian government. And Franco Freda was one of the leaders of the fascist faction. He was called a Nazi Maoist because he was a fan of Hitler, he's a fan of Mussolini, and he was also influenced by Mao's third worldist theory, and he had large support by the student body, and he was connected, like he's believed to have been connected to like several terrorist attacks that took place during the years of Lead, but the country basically almost bursted into a full-on civil war because of him. And he was one of those like Red Brown Alliance work with the Soviet Union to destroy the West. Same with like Otto Ernst Riemer, the guy, the leader of the Socialist Reich Party. He's also the dude who prevented Hitler from dying during Operation Valkyrie. Collaborated with Castro, Nasser. Like even Yaki had these views that the Soviets were better off, and you can see this with like Alain de Benoist, which is like a modern French New Right thinker. Better to be a Soviet soldier than being an American eating the hamburger in Brooklyn. Like this is very common in our movement.
A lot of deep, like deeply, especially reactionary or Catholic anti-communists, they love Franco. Well, Franco had very good relationships with Cuba and Fidel Castro. And so did Pinochet.
Yeah.
Pinochet had a good relationship with Fidel Castro. Like, so again,
Castro is a phalangist LARPing as a communist, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's kind of amazing. Like, Cuba is a majority black country now after all the whites left. And yet the government, like some bug man actually went to Cuba recently and wrote about it in, I believe, Vice. And he was complaining that the Cuban ballet was all white. Like, so, you know, imagine that. Like, you know, this is totally different. There's so much nuance in these things that you have to take these things and kind of parse them out. You can't just be like, I hate communism, I love Franco, and then Franco's like hanging out with Castro. Like, you can't just ignore that, you know. And so I have my own opinions. I have my very strong critiques of Castro, of course, but the point is that that sometimes, you know, you have to be a pragmatic actor, politically speaking, in some of these things, you know. And when it comes to Russia and China, if they're undermining Zog globally in some form, whether it's kicking them out of the Middle East or supporting the Iranians, or hell, even having Russia Today publishing articles that are defending the civil liberties of the people that are being tortured in American prisons over the January 6th protests.
There's literally a guy blind. There was a guy blinded while he was arrested. They don't even talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's illegal. Obviously, it's only because it's illegal. I would never take money from them or anything. But nevertheless, if they're doing their own thing and there's common interest, I don't really care what Alexander Dugin or whatever the fuck. I don't care what any of those people think. Let them think whatever they want.
I personally think his multipolarity idea is actually pretty useful because it allows us like undermine like American Atlanticism, at least when it comes to, like spreading liberalism. But that'd probably make them autistic.
And if you're a National Socialist shilling for Atlanticism, let me remind you of something called the Second World War. you know, what if the Soviets had not been completely enabled by American Atlanticism, they would have been defeated very easily in the war. Not easily, but they would have lost the war without American industry providing tons of aid. That's my view on that. So if you want to understand what the reason why we had communism for the entire 20th century, look no further than Washington. That's where it comes from.
William F. Buckley was one of the big people behind like the entire like modern conservative movement, and he was pretty big on the anti-communist stuff too. Same with like McCarthy, who's believed to be like secretly a homosexual, but it's a different conversation of its own.
Well, I said this to Ayatollah, the British guy, the last time I spoke to him. I said, "You want to know basically a conservative in the English-speaking world is just a blackmailed homosexual. That's what a conservative is. Because there's no way an honest person can come to the conclusions using sound reasoning that they do. You're going to combine market economics with social conservatism. It's just not feasible. It's not possible.
This, okay? I just thought of something interesting that
One other thing, too. If you look at the, say, conservative campaign about whining about what China is doing in their own turf, you know, Hong Kong, and talking about China, you know, I've seen some foreign policy publications on this. One of their ideas for containing Chinese influence, Chinese Communist Party, one of their brilliant ideas is to take all the industry out of China and move it to where? Vietnam. So you want to fight the communist Chinese by building up the communist Vietnamese. And you say that's anti-communism. Well, I mean, it shows you how it's all about propaganda and how much you repeat a message, because unlike the Chinese, well, the Chinese did fight America directly, but the Vietnamese fought a very recent war with America. And the government that fought the war against America is in charge. And now the people in Washington are trying to use the Vietnamese to try and as one of the various prongs to contain Chinese influence in Asia. It doesn't even make any fucking sense. It's just retarded. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, it's fine. I actually wanted to bring this up because there's some people who try to say that Hitler wasn't socialist because of the purge of like the SA and Strasser brothers, but like that's actually not true, I would argue, because like you can go through Alfred Rosenberg's memoirs. He talks about how Gregor was not supposed to be purged. Like for some reason he was literally on the death list. They didn't know why he was on the death list. It pissed Hitler off. And he's supposed to be Minister of the Interior, which is like a high ranking position within the government in terms of like the economic side.
Yeah.
And this is also talked about in Gregor Strasser, a biography by Stratura, which is actually a good read. I'd recommend it. Well, he ends up dying, and like Rosenberg was told to have like people investigate it by Hitler. They investigated it, and they couldn't get any information out of it. So he came to the conclusion that it was Göring or Himmler that were behind having them executed, and it was because of political reasons.
It was because they were working with Ernst Röhm So essentially, this is my understanding of what happened. And of course, there's the dummies that say that Hitler killed the Strasser brothers over an economics debate, which is
like he didn't even kill Röhm because he disagreed with him on economics. He was literally peer pressured into it by Himmler and Göring.
I would say
also a fag too. So that was the reason. But
well, that I don't even think it was that Hitler knew that the whole time. What it was that Röhm was getting too big for his britches. And he had this essentially gigantic paramilitary group, and he was essentially moving. This is my understanding, and I've actually consulted with various people that know quite a bit about the era on this. Basically, Röhm and Strasser, this is what is believed, were mad that Hitler was moving too slowly. They didn't like the coalition that he was elected to with the conservatives. They didn't like that, and they wanted Hitler to essentially like literally start killing, like, I don't know, clerics and industrialists and aristocrats and so on. Now, Hitler was a pragmatist. He wasn't a murderer. So his idea was that he would build parallel institutions, right? So the Wehrmacht was quite a bit, compacted with these kind of entitled Junkers and aristocrats and Bonds, right? So what Hitler wanted to do is he would build an ideological version of the Wehrmacht to compete with it internally, called the SS, which later became the Waffen-SS. Then you have, of course, the industrialists. Well, Hitler said, okay, well, I'm just going to take a lot. I'm going to take a lot of property and just give it to, you know, have it be run by the state by giving it to party members. And number two, I'm going to put a progressive tax on, say, the war industries of 90%.
I am aware of what you're talking about on that. So most of the people who like attribute like to him wanting to stage like a military revolution, he did call on Hitler to like complete the revolution by merging the SA into the military, which like some generals started the civil war over that. But Rom, as far as I know, never like threatened to like actively. There's no citation for like him wanting to overthrow the government. As for Gregor, one of the things that the conservatives did, that they actually tried to undercut Hitler by giving Gregor a position in the government, which would have took Hitler's base away and would have like split the party in two. But instead, Gregor resigned entirely, which kept Hitler in power.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so yeah, so it is disputed.
It is disputed. It's disputed in the same ways. There's some people who claim that like Hitler was funded by Silverberg, a Jew, which is false. God. There's people who also claim that Gregor was funded by Silverberg to undermine Hitler, which is also literally a meme.
Yeah, it's all there's a lot of nonsense. I was talking about this actually on Strike and Mike last week or earlier in the week with Mike about like these old Klan pamphlets by like guys like Lieutenant Colonel Mohr, M-O-H-R. And this guy was like he was a Klan guy in the, I believe, the 70s. And he wrote this bizarre pamphlet called The Hitler Cult, which is on the one hand anti-Jewish and, you know, racialist, but on the other hand claims that Hitler was a quarter Jewish and that the Warburgs were funding him. And that the Warburgs funded communists and Nazis in Germany to bring about a totalitarian regime. And it's just pure. He's just pulling this stuff out of his ass.
If you want to see what the Germans thought of the Klan, you can just look at anti-American propaganda for that one. If you know which photo I'm talking about. But
yeah,
the Klan are such trash, though. Like for like when it came to like lynchings, they killed so many. They killed more Italians and they killed black. Like they targeted mostly Italians. Like,
yeah, they targeted, the original lynch, according to my understanding, was an Irish guy. It was something that, it was just like frontier
Irish
war.
And Italians, it was like the two people they targeted Italians the most, but it was Irish and Italians that they targeted.
well, what's interesting is that there are many iterations of the Klan, and some of them were not particularly anti-Jewish. I believe there was one.
Some of them were Anglo-Israelis.
Well, they were mostly Baptists until probably very recently. That's when they've taken up the Christian identity thing. But
Anglo-Israelism is older than like modern Christian identity. It literally argues that like the only Anglos are specifically a lost tribe of Israel. So like they believe that they are specifically Jewish, whereas like other European groups are not. Broader Christian identity argues that all Europeans are basically Israel.
Ah, I see.
So there's a difference.
But some of the stuff I've seen now, I know that in the last 30 years or so, like the Klan is not anti-Nazi, but
nowadays there's a lot of Nat socks involved in it, but I still think it's a meme. But
yeah, I mean, it is what it is. But in when it comes to the Second World War, the Klan was very, very much anti-Nazi and had no qualms going to Europe and killing Europeans. So whenever the way I troll leftists and say, well, my grandfather fought in the Second World War, he's an original Antifa, I say, well, he was probably also in the Klan. You know, the guys that stormed Omaha Beach were above average, more likely to be Southerners, and tons of those guys were in the Klan, or were in the Klan at some point. So you basically, you know, had Klansmen punching Nazis. So like, which side do they take? You know, because these are two memes that leftists have built as these like embodying pure evil. And it's just so ridiculous that they're talking about this American army that was literally racially segregated to the point where the Nazis even commented on it. So I mean, that whole argument is stupid. But yeah, you know, it's funny, Zoltanis, how this thing where, you know, you got this guy, Lieutenant Colonel Moore, he disagrees with National Socialism, which is fine. He has a right to disagree. But instead of attacking it ideologically, he just makes stuff up about Hitler, you know. And I think that's a very toxic political thing that you still see in America in modern times. Oh,
that's all they do about third position, like fascism's capitalism and decay, and then Hitler is like free market capitalist, or he's literally Stalin.
Oh, they don't even do that anymore. Now they just attack. Like I saw the New York Times published a ridiculous study that claimed that Hitler was a Jewish mulatto.
They also have stuff that says he has one testicle too.
Oh, and he was gay and he used to eat shit. And I mean, yeah. Every ridiculous thing. And of course they do it because no historian will have the balls. Even one that's not a pro Hitler historian will have the balls to stand up and say, there's no proof of that. That's not true. I know this because I've worked with people in historian academics, history academics, and you know, they let all types of bullshit fly because they're afraid of being perceived as defending the Nazis. So this is just a problem overall.
Yeah, it's I would find it more like easier for me to like respect the left if they kind of had like the same clout as Mussolini like did, because like Mussolini, when it came to like, his political enemies, he like, even in Italy, like, when he was in charge, he would challenge them to fencing duels, and if they would win, he would let them go free.
And
he won a lot of them, but he did lose a couple.
Well, let's look at how the fascists treated their opponents versus how the communists treated the fascists. Okay, there's no exile. You just get killed. And that's kind of the ridiculous nature, the delusional nature of their claims that, oh, fascists are particularly brutal.
They only have 60 confirmed like political assassinations or tortures.
Right.
Of like political enemies.
Mm-hmm. So let's get to the questions. Are you there, Borzoi?
I put them in the chat as well, but I can read them 1 second.
Oh, no worries, man. Oh, you put them in the chat, huh?
Let me put the headphones back on.
I'll take a look at the chat.
I got them right here. Here we go.
Okay.
So Tam donates $20. Thank you, Tam.
Oh, thank you, Tam. Good old Tam.
Yep. Let's see here. Blue Division donates $5. Just sending some love.
Oh, I know Blue Division. He's a good boy. Thanks, Blue Division.
Okay, good. My mic's showing up on there, too. Good. All right. MP donates $30. Couldn't listen to the live show, but wanted to get my support in. I am loving Cultured Grugs. It's a great read. Well, thank you. And always appreciate Stryker's journalism.
Oh, thanks, buddy. Appreciate that.
Alrighty. Borzette donates $25. More fodder to teach the Borsling about the greatness of fascism. And then she adds a smiley face at the end.
Oh, that's nice.
Glenn the Chinaman donates 10. Capitalists and conservative politicians offer immigration as a solution to declining population. Did you know immigration actually causes fertility to collapse even faster, as well as migrants' fertility rate eventually converges to the native population? It only compounds the problem and creates new issues.
Well, yeah, and of course, and I mean, think about the concept of that. It's like, your children are sick, so instead of fixing whatever is ailing them or taking them to a doctor, you simply adopt new children. That's essentially what they're doing.
They're actually starting to push that in Japan now under Abe.
Oh, yeah. And Abe is the conservative.
Yep.
So who is there to vote for in these parliamentary plutocracies? Like, if the far right figure, Abe, is considered by international standards to be relatively far right, as they say, and he's the one that's opening the borders up. And if you, again, people get mad when I say this, but it's always going to be true. Go to Sweden. It was the moderate party, the center right party, that started the immigration wave. You look at the weakness of the Tories in the United Kingdom now on immigration. I mean, the fact that European descended people are a minority in London, which I believe is true. If they're not a minority, they're 51% or something.
In London, it's British, the actual ethnic British stock that are the minority. Because I think that you can fudge the numbers with having other white Europeans included as numbers. It's specifically the white British, the actual British, who are the minority within their own city.
Yeah, well, what are the Tories doing about this?
They're the ones that are responsible for pushing most of the woke policies, not even Labour. Like, most of the woke policies you see in Britain come from the Conservatives.
Who is that woman that was the Prime Minister and she had to resign recently, in the recent years?
Oh, God, I can't remember her name.
Shit, I can't remember.
In Britain?
Yes.
Oh, Theresa May.
Oh, yeah.
Theresa May. Now, she's a Tory, and she was like doing like woke stuff on the police before even it was cool. Like, she was doing like, she was calling like the Metropolitan Police Department, or whatever they're called, the bobbies, saying that they were institutionally racist for stopping blacks at higher rates, and started to put in through the Home Office, started to do reforms in the Home Office where they're not allowed to stop and frisk blacks and so on. Well, lo and behold, a few years later, Britain has like Brazil levels of knife crime. I mean, you know, these are the right wing people doing this. You know, they're worse than nothing. They're worse than nothing. Boris Johnson is worse than nothing. At least if what's his face would have won, Corbyn, it would have at least been funny or interesting, because Jews were freaking out about him. But they're actually the Tories are just garbage, and they are responsible as much as the Labour Party for the racial replacement of the British people. So, and I can go through every country in the West and show you the same dynamic.
Oh, Abe isn't prime minister anymore. It's a guy called Suga.
Okay. What?
Yeah, Abe. Yeah, Abe resigned last year. He was one of the longest serving prime ministers, though, in Japanese history, because he had at least two tenures.
I do have a friend in Japan that told me most of the pause stuff was going on underneath him. They had this thing called Abenomics that was trying to bring more women into the workforce, bring more immigrants into the workforce.
Yeah, and then you wonder, okay, so all the women are in the workforce, and your cities are getting really dangerous because of the immigration. Then you wonder why people aren't having children. Well, there you have it.
Having charity and not having children as it is.
And, right, and on this, exactly. On this topic of Shinzo Abe and the conservatives in Japan, I'm going to read a quote to you from the Pentagon's new map, which was by Department of Defense wonk Thomas Burnett. Now, this week there was some fake quotes from the book going around. There's been actually a lot of fake quotes associated with this book, but the material within the book is still shocking. It's just when you see like when you see stuff like about oh he's advocating for like a 90 IQ population, it's like that stuff's not in there. That's way too on the that's way too on the nose. I wish people would not make up fake quotes about this stuff, because if you read it, it's bad enough as it is. But these are the type of people that Shinzo Abe was basically cozying up with in order to try and rearm Japan and you know, because the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan is a neoconservative party. But as for Japan, as much as one-third of its 2050 population would be foreign-born if they pursued the immigration rate required to stabilize their absolute number of working-age citizens. Simply put, that wouldn't be Japan anymore. That would be an entirely new country. I personally believe that would be a better Japan, because I think that insular society has so much to offer the world that letting more of that world in will let the Japanese achieve the normal nationhood they have sought ever since their brush with the apocalypse in 1945. Such are the tides of history.
Yeah, it seems also that they're training a kind of bugman class in Japan to perhaps lead the liberal human rights neocon struggle against China. I think that rearmament for Japan, if China annexes Taiwan, rearmament for Japan is definitely in the cards. And I think they're just preparing them for that. They want Japan to be a racially incoherent shithole so that when they do rearm, they won't be a threat to world plutocracy in any ever again. So there is a rhyme and reason to what they're doing. It's not just want to see more brown people or something. There's a logic to it.
What you're saying is actually similar to what Kazuri Yamada has said before, like in some of his interviews. He's like the leader of like a Japanese National Socialist Party, though.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that racially incoherent countries can never be a independent threat to the powerful. But they can still be functional enough if they have enough intelligent people, like in Japan. They can still be functional enough to operate a military apparatus in a relatively competent way.
Brazil, so, too. That's yeah. That's the future.
Oh, yeah. Sure. And, you know, this is...
If Brazil's so great, why haven't they announced Brazil, too? Brazil, too, announced.
Well, the thing with Brazil is that, you know, I was talking about this recently. There's actually a secessionist movement in southern Brazil. Now, if you don't know about this, southern Brazil is racially and culturally more similar to Uruguay and Argentina than it is to the rest of the Brazil.
Which they have borders, a yeah. strong integralist movement over there too. They like firebombed like some like pornography building like a
yeah,
couple
it
years
was
ago.
it was a show. It was a TV show that depicted Jesus as a homosexual, and they firebombed the production company building.
I've always kind of seen integralism as kind of. I'm not too crazy about it, though I understand what they're doing.
It's the same thing as like Spanish fascism under Jose. It's like an anti. It's not. It's like a non-racial version of fascism. But like
yeah.
the reason why it's like that is because of pan-Hispanicism, which is like it has Africans, it has Europeans, and it has the natives under like an Hispanic identity. But that you don't.
That
I don't,
stuff
I
is nonsense. That stuff is fucking nonsense.
Well, yeah, the way they enforced it was through a caste system and like Catholicism, which is how they partly maintained control and also strong autocratic states. But you don't really
like
have that anymore.
It was like the British Commonwealth. That's essentially the equivalent of it. Like there's this notion that the Spanish were less racist than the British or something. It's all bullshit. Anyone who tells you that is a liar.
Yeah, it was just a way to use like Catholicism to maintain like
to maintain
control.
The order, right? Yeah. That's it was to maintain the empire, and the British did something very similar with the Anglican Church and so on through the, and they still have the British. Unlike the Spanish, the British still have the Commonwealth. And you know, all the people in the Commonwealth, they're supposed to defer to the Queen and so on. I find all that stuff to be not just outdated, but also nonsensical.
Giving rewards to love, honey.
Like, but I think that ultimately, though, the problem with integrity, I would say that there are two distinct forces in Brazil And the more realistic one is the secessionist one. Like Southern Brazil, there's no reason for Southern Brazil to be connected to, mm-hmm. to the rest of that country.
Well,
it's very unique. It's a European majority region with its own independent culture that is completely distinct culturally, financially, racially to the rest of Brazil. If I had the power to create, create coherent nations in Latin America, it wouldn't be through that pan-Hispanicist bullshit. It would be through, and I know that people like Bolivar and stuff believe in that. The real sense of the reasonable thing to do in that context would be to create a new state with Argentina, Southern Brazil, and Uruguay, which would actually create another white superpower if they did that. But instead, you have all these ridiculous nations that don't even make any sense, and that's why a lot of Latin America is such a fucking mess.
Well, the modern integralists—they're actually different than what they were historically. They do like the modern ones in Brazil do support secession, and they're more woke on racial issues, including like JQ. Like the old school integralists weren't.
Were not.
Yeah,
Brazil
there's a difference.
Fought against the Axis in World War II.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. Secessionism in Brazil was actually, in southern Brazil, was won a referendum before Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro kind of de-radicalized a lot of the southern Brazilians that were getting mad about the crime and corruption.
Yeah, the kosher conservative.
Just like Trump. And that's another dumb thing that, like, you know, the right wing, the Tucker Carlson talking point, that the Democrats are replacing Republican voters so that they can create this like liberal, like ultra liberal state or whatever. Brazil is much, much, much less white than America, and Bolsonaro is much, much more right wing on paper aesthetically than Trump is. So that's clearly not true.
He's now, also targeting political enemies like that Greenwald guy, gay Jew.
Oh yeah, I remember when I used to say good things about Glenn Greenwald. There'd be people like in that reactionary sphere of NRX sphere that would call me names and so on. But what I was saying is that, you know, Glenn Greenwald, who's a queer Jew, is actually willing to go out there and defend my very basic civil rights. Bolsonaro isn't, because he gets all his talking points from Tel Aviv. Okay, that's the problem. So you know, fuck Bolsonaro.
One thing I never understood about NRX is like how hard they rail against like say like third position, and they talk so much like shit about like liberalism, but then here they are like shilling for like Stop the Steal and like Reagan and Thatcher for being tools against like communism and stuff. Like it just seems kind of ironic.
I think that they're very big about the Wignat stuff, which I don't even know what that means anymore. It's just a stupid,
derogatory for like anybody who's like a real nationalist and doesn't like Jews.
It's an anti-heterosexual slur and always has been.
Well, the term changes every 5 minutes because, like, you know, there are people that are self-described Wignats that are, you know, I don't want to fed jacket them, but they're clearly like they're clearly glows. In some
cases. The siege guys.
Well, some of those, yeah, not all of them, but some of those guys. I mean,
they started calling me a Fed because I disavowed Siege, but.
Well, you know, Siege, the book Siege isn't bad. It's not a bad book. There's interesting stuff in that book if you read it objectively, but if you create this whole like there's a whole subculture around it that's like black metal edgelords combined with like
They literally post photos of like Islamic people with like the siege aesthetics, and we support all forms of terrorism. And it's like, okay, guy, okay.
Yeah, like, you know, I'm reading this book actually by David Getty. He was it's called Undercover Nazi, and it's interesting to me because it's a memoir from an undercover FBI informant that infiltrated all these like white nationalist groups in the 2000s, and there's a part in it where the FBI actually created a motorcycle gang called the SS Cavalier Division or something. So they were a outlaw motorcycle gang that was also Nazi, that also declared allegiance to Osama bin Laden. So this is completely started from scratch by the FBI. And he was like, and he talks about it, and they were able to convince this mentally ill guy, August Christ III, which I'm not sure if you could still find it, but he used to go on Jerry Springer a lot. He was clearly mentally ill, and the feds were toying with him. And this guy declared that this like Fed-run group was now the detachment of the Aryan nations. It's a whole very, very interesting history. But, you know, there's stuff going on. I'm not going to comment on it. It's better to ignore it. But the point is, though, is that the Wignat thing is now, like, totally played out. It's basically now...
Just a slur comes from Nick.
Well, Wignat now is now, like, a term that, like, really resentful Jews and non-whites use against anyone. I mean, you know, I don't hate people just because of who they are or anything, but they just assume that and they call you a Wignat or something. But it's like, you know, it's played out. And the fact that the reason NRX guys are constantly going around saying, oh, that guy who criticizes Trump is a Wignat, that guy is a Fed, that guy is this, that guy is that. The reason they do it is because they don't have an argument.
They spend several hours trying to convince you that Hitler was secretly homosexual, referencing that mold bug and conversation.
And if there's one rule of thumb when it comes to the internet, is that anyone accusing you of being a homosexual, that's spreading rumors about someone being homosexual or Jewish or non-white or a Fed or anything like that, anyone who's spreading rumors very recklessly like that, is usually one or all of those things. That's a good rule of thumb of the internet. But anyway, let's move on.
You might need to take the next one. I have all a crying right, boy right. here.
Oh, boy.
Junta Momonari is the next one. Go ahead and take it.
All right. So it says here, Junta Momonari donates $10. Have you seen the documentary Princes of the Yen? About finance capitalists in Japan engineering a financial crisis in order to pressure the government to implement economic reforms, even in the absence of Jews. Capitalists want complete open borders and capital and labor. I've never seen that, but that does sound very interesting. And I agree with you. Capital is kind of its own thing. It needs to be ruthlessly disciplined by the government. And anytime capitalists become stronger than the state, you will have a dictatorship of billionaires, even if there's no Jews. That's always how it's always been, you know. And of course, Jews will come back in that. When you artificially elevate the merchant class over the philosopher kings, the military, you know, as in the wisdom of the Aryan Indian caste system, which, you know, obviously have critiques of that, but there is a wisdom to that, that the Brahmins and the warriors are above the merchant class. When the merchant class is put in charge through these bourgeois liberal revolutions, that's when you get the slow degradation and degeneration of your nation. That's how it always happens. So, yeah, I agree with that. So it says, the next question is, Xi Jinping donates $5. Thank you, Xi Jinping. I guess that's going to
increase your social credit score.
Yes, our social credit score. I'm back, by the way. Yeah, our social credit score is doing fantastic these days.
Huh. And our friend Tom is here. Tom donates $25. I'm Polish in America. My wife is Chinese. We both hope that we whites will take our country back. You know, Tom, I think, Borzo, what do you think? Tom is one of the most long-standing fans, isn't he?
You know, he's become a meme to the point where people do the snow clone of his thing. Like, I am X and my wife is Y. We both want the NJP to win. You know, Tom's been with us, I think, from very early episodes, because I remember seeing those donations early on. So if he wasn't from the very first episode, he was very early on.
No, Tom is an OG. So thanks, Tom, for sticking around. So is there anything else, Borzoi?
Yeah, Zero Schizo just brought did two separate donations. First donation for $5 on the topic of Hispanism. This is not a racial movement, has never been, will never be. In order to understand it, you'd have to get outside of the racial thinking, which is literally impossible for Americans.
Well, what is a Hispanic? A Hispanic, and this is something I've said on Telegram, Hispanic is a person who is a combination of Celtic and Iberian and is from Spain. That's Hispanic. It's like saying Anglo-Saxon, the Anglo-Saxon movement. You know, there are many blacks and American Indians and people of all types of races who are, you could make the using the Hispanicist or whatever argument, you could say the same about them, that they're Anglo-Saxons. It doesn't even make any sense. And I find that oftentimes when you see stuff like, for example, Cosmic Race from Mexico, right? And I'll say this very critically of the whites who do this in Mexico. There's like a minority of white people. They dominate the country. A lot of them are crypto Jews, actually. But, you know, when someone like Vicente Fox declares himself a cosmic mestizo, what he's doing is he's duping the Indians of his country. And they use that Hispanicist. It's like Zoltanus was saying, it's just a way to retain certain types of power relations. Now, I don't believe, and I catch flack because, for example, I was supporting Evo Morales in Bolivia and the Native Americans there, because I think Bolivia, which is like 95% Native American, that their government should reflect the population. I don't think like some like bottle blonde like some bottle blonde mixed race porn star that's backed by Washington.
That's why I support the Zapatistas, which is probably surprising for some people.
Right. So like people like you know wealthy European or Jewish descended capitalists in Mexico, they have no solidarity with the people they govern, and they have no solidarity with other people of European descent. They take all their poor Indians and they send them to America. Fuck them. I support all those groups like the Zapatistas. I support them to an extent in the sense that they are indigenous. They fight for their people's rights. The vast majority of people in Mexico are some kind of Indian, and they should be able to have a government that looks like them. That's a universal principle that I think is ethical and justified. You know, I'm not for oppressing Native Americans. You see this in Bolivia too. The elites in Bolivia, the people on that are from Wall Street that own all the different natural gas industries there, but also the local, some people call them white, whatever they are. Those guys send all their Bolivians to Argentina. So there's millions of Bolivians living in Argentina now because the ruling class in their country does not has disenfranchised them and sends them abroad. So I support nationalism for all these different groups.
I'm going to read what Zero Schizo was saying in the chat. Since he's an old friend of the show, I'm going to read a couple of things he said in the chat here while you were explaining all that. He says, that's a Spaniard. A Hispanic is someone who has his cultural roots in Spain. It is not relevant if he is from Germany or from the Andes. It is a civilizational identity. Borzoi tells Stricker that's a civilizational identity, like being Roman or Ottoman or something like that. So that's his perspective
on
that.
Okay. What would Zero Schizo say that that people living in the Commonwealth, in the British Commonwealth, is that a civilizational identity then?
Or
Kenyans, Anglo-Saxons?
You could probably argue that like the Atlanticist identity is more like an Anglo construct, and America is kind of an extension of Anglos and like Jews. So like you could probably argue that for modern Western civilization is Atlanticist.
Yeah, because there is a tendency in Latin American history of some figures like Simon Bolivar, even Juan Perón to some degree, that believe in to some extent in this concept. But the problem is, whatever their flaws or pros and cons may be, they've always struggled to really make sense of that, because frankly, people in these countries don't like each other. People in Colombia don't like people in Venezuela, and vice versa. People in Argentina, you talk to a white working class person from Argentina, they don't want millions of Peruvians and Bolivians in their country. Go look at the opinion polls. So, you know, this whole thing is ridiculous. It's not a civilizational identity to try and combine. Civilization is based on blood. It's not based on language or even religion. Because again, if it is, then Kenya is part of the British civilization. South Africa is part of the British and Dutch civilization. The Philippines, which these people that talk about civilizational identity, does that mean the Filipinos are Hispanic? It doesn't make any sense.
I kind of wish I wasn't hadn't been like paying attention to the donations and I had listened to all that, because I guess what some, because Louis Conde, who I know pretty well, is saying Stryker is equating Criollo with Hispanic, which is not 1-to-1.
So, well, I guess this is just a disagreement based on how people sense or see a civilization. If you believe a civilization is based in blood and you know that the ties of blood, then you have a very different opinion than someone who believes that civilization is based on linguistic categories or a shared religion. You know, Filipinos are very strongly influenced by the Spanish language. They have Spanish names. They were under the Spanish crown for many years. They're Catholic. Why aren't they part of the Hispanic civilization then? If that's, you know, that's my critique of that. I'm going to assert that this whole Hispanic thing is actually the American invention. I mean, North America, United States American, it's a fake category created by, influenced by Saul Alinsky, created in the 1970s to create a voting bloc of white Cubans, black Puerto Ricans, and Mexican Indians. It's absurd, okay? And you're seeing some of that coalition and identity breaking up now, where you see people starting to say, like, wait, all these Cubans voted for Trump. All these black Puerto Ricans voted for Biden. So you can't really make any political sense of that, because it's not a real group. So that's my view of that.
Because I think this is going to spark another sketch. I'll go to Zero Schizo's other donation of $3. Okay. On the topic of Brazil, Borzoi should invite the leader of NR Brazil, Rafael Machado. He is on Twitter, and he can explain why what you're not saying is true regarding southern Brazil.
Okay, well, he can disagree. I know people in southern Brazil that agree with my perspective on this, so he can disagree if he wants, and more power to him. But yes, that's my opinion on
this. Third position is having differences of opinion. That's unheard of.
Oh, yeah.
Reminds me of the Fascist Internationale there in 1934.
That's good. That's actually a good example there. This is the last donation, unless somebody squeaks one in at the end. Tactical Boomerism donates $14 simply to say N. So if anyone else wants to complete that N tower, you better start slamming those donations right now, because we're at the end here.
Is that it?
Yeah, that's it right there.
Oh my god. Right.
Do you have anything to plug, Zoltanis?
Just give me a second. I'm probably just going to go ahead and like read something like I was writing on the document I was working on responding to his fascism, capitalism, decay. In reality, fascism retained a Sorellian myth and Hegelian idealism, a conception of history that no longer believed in ends, but an endless struggle like that in Schopenhauer's view of life. To Sorel, who concluded progress is an illusion. It adopted the syndicalism of Sorel, ancient feudal guilds of the socialist past, as inspiration, and the Christian social teachings for an organic society, allowing for corporatism to be formulated as a concept. with its modernism and industrialized nations, it never regressed backwards into agrarian relations of production, not traditionalism of the reactionaries, but futurism with its emphasis on not just technology or modernization, but also the militaristic structuring of society, going back to Sparta and the Roman Empire. Fascism glorified action, war, violence like Sorel as part of the myth. It became a cult of death in a sense, worshipped its martyrs who died for its revolution, to warrior poets from D'Annunzio to Kurt Eggers. The new man who overcame the world that is materialistic with a will to power, as Nietzsche predicted, allowing himself to overcome himself. Thus he overcame his detractors by struggle. The struggle culminated into a national will to power that became the basis of the totalitarian state. Duty became the norm of this hierarchy because it wasn't just political. It was a worldview based upon a new man, a new society, and a new world. This was the revolutionary implications fascism played itself on. And it was a continuation of the idealistic past, going from Hegel to Kant to Fichte, a revolution that was holistic in its practice of socialism. And that's all I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, think of the concept of self-sacrifice. That does not occur to a materialist thinker.
It's mentioned in the Doctrine of Fascism. Like, it's not rational for a man to run into trenches and get mowed down by a gun.
Right.
The RDT were the perfect example.
And you know, the Anglo-liberal, say, analytical tradition, which is entirely, you know, it's highly materialistic and highly based in, of course, the analytical tradition has said, this is why, like, Jews were able to take over Britain and America without a single shot being fired. There's nothing for us here. This is why we have to build.
But Stryker, don't you know we have to have liberalism, individual rights.
Right. I mean, and you know what's so interesting about, before we leave, Zoltanis, is that you can see that people are thrashing, trying to break out of the liberal paradigm. And you saw that on January 6th. Now, that's not to say that I endorse violence or criminal actions at all. But those people were there under ostensibly liberal pretenses, you know. But the soul was clearly trying to break from those shackles. And you see this over and over again. People are starving for tradition, starving for collectivism, starving for identity in America. And I think that through these nationalist ideas, we can give people exactly what they need. And that's why I think in the end, we're going to be victorious in this. So, yes.
Yeah, just the main problem right now is just trying to set up parallel structures so you can actually do that in the future. Just, it seems kind of hard to organize everybody for it, but I feel like if you have a group that gets the parallel structure is actually set up and you get enough investment into it and it starts doing well, everybody will fall in line underneath that party. I hope the NJP actually ends up being that party, but there's a couple other organizations trying to do that too.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that it's obvious that they agree with us, because if they didn't, they wouldn't ruthlessly oppress us like they do. You know, we do everything in our power to follow the law and engage in politics and so on. And they have made it so difficult just to speak your mind in this country, just to read what you want. This is truly these are uncharted waters we're going into in American history. And it's simply not, it's not because of some mystical liberal omnipresence that was defending the Constitution of the United States.
Yeah, the tabula rasa stuff.
Right, no.
Magic dirt.
Right, it's not because of that. It's because it was more difficult for people to access different ideas before the internet. Now, with the age of the internet, I mean, before we go, I know Borzo has to go, but before we go, I was watching the McCain Institute, which is named after the lame ass known as John McCain. The McCain Institute had like two or three panels just focused on white supremacists, the domestic terrorists. Of course, they call people, you know, there's no white supremacist domestic terrorists. They use that as a catch-all term that includes even like Proud Boys and stuff. But the point is, they're really obsessed with the idea that now people can disagree with the government and the elites, and all they do is meet together. All these high-powered people meet together to figure out ways to destroy us, and that's not very good. You know, I'm not too worried. What happens, happens. In the end, history will be our judge.
So, I look forward to the day we seize the means of production from the Jews. So,
indeed. So, all right. I think that's about it. Play us out.
Well, just quickly, there'll be a third rail tomorrow, and I'm going to say this, and then I'm playing the music. We're not restarting the discussion on this, but because he donated, I'm going to let him have the last word on this. Zero Schizo donating the $3. Hispanic is much more ancient. What Stryker means is Latino, which was literally created by the French and used via propaganda by the U.S. in order to promote the invasion of Mexico. But I'm going to play us out now. We're not restarting this discussion.
Yeah.